Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
When I was nine, my father, Paddy Devlin, put a pen in one of my hands and an electoral register in the other and showed me how to write election addresses onto polling cards. As a result, by the time I was 17, politics was my rock and roll. I remember a photograph of myself. It's the first photo I have ever really liked. I look womanish. I'm staying with Joan. She's a secretary in the party office. She works with my dad on elections and lives in a flat overlooking the Botanic Gardens. My mother and father have left me there for the weekend with a cooked chicken. She lent me one of her swimming costumes, black, with a black mesh midriff. Because for the first time since I was a kid, I have a midriff that summer. In the photo, I'm on her balcony in sunlight. Well, actually, I climbed out of a window onto the porch above the front door and posed. Coming, Barbarella. I still think I look like the girl in the photo 2 weeks after my 17th birthday when I run for the bus. It's parked outside Queen's, in the forecourt in front of the Union. It's the single-decker Ulster Transport bus that will take us to Derry. The bus is full when I reach it, but my friends have kept me a seat. They are students and graduates mostly, and I am a schoolgirl. I shouldn't even be on the bus. But I joined the Young Socialists earlier in the summer, and they can't get rid of me. Even when they set me tasks like sewing the banner, I cannot thread a needle. So I buy white adhesive fabric from which I cut out letters and stick them onto the banner with a hot iron. And because four of us have been to see Yellow Submarine in the cinema a few months before, we sing on the bus. We all live in a fascist regime. When we arrive in Derry, there are occupied police tenders parked in steep side streets. It's the first time I've been to Derry, and I'm busy thinking, what are all those police vehicles doing on the slopes? Until Roger, who looks like John Lennon in an iron sweater, says, oh, look, blue meanies. In Duke Street, when we are stopped, James puts a megaphone to his mouth and makes a speech. The problem with standing next to a megaphone is you can't hear anything but noise. You need to stand in front of it to hear. In front of me are four lines of people, and James is talking into the backs of their heads. I must have got distracted because suddenly the lines of marchers have melted until there is no one, except in my frame of vision, a dark uniformed figure, peaked cap shading his eyes, his arm raised in front of his face, the truncheon and extension of the arm, his other hand cupping his elbow. He swings his left knee towards the raised arm in perfect balance while facing me from the middle of a line of men. He screws up his face and snarls, like the principal dancer whose balletic movement I am blocking. Get out of the road if you don't want to get hurt. I run back along the street to where I find James standing on the edge of the pavement. He looks odd. Then I notice a trickle from his hairline to his jaw and onto his collar. A man moves swiftly towards us and guides us into a closed public house, where he gives me a pan of hot water and cloth and leaves me feeling like Saint Veronica. In the lobby of the City Hotel, a row of telephone booths with those concertina doors fully extended are occupied by cubs and veterans phoning their copy in urgent carefully paced sentences to national editors. We believed that Britain was a fairer place to live than where we did. My family never looked to Dublin. All my mother's sisters went to England for work. My father's paper was the Manchester Guardian. My grandmother read The Universe. The Beatles were the Irish in England, and Liverpool was Pepperland. I stayed up all night when Harold Wilson was elected. I never understood why the English could keep changing their government and we had the same one for 50 years. And when the 6 o'clock news came on from London on the 5th of October, we watched young ghosts of ourselves pass on the other side of a glass wall. I gathered those 50 years into my face, and no one came back from Derry.
Strength of this world, and I'm proud to fight for freedom with a rebel girl.
Don't speak to the Brits, just pretend they don't exist. Two rubber bullets stand on the shelf from Bloody Sunday, mounted in silver. Space rockets docked and ready to go off. Like the sky ray lolly that crimsons your lips when the orange quencher your brother gets attracts a wasp that stings him on the tongue. Tongue is what they call the Irish language, native tongue you're learning at school. Kathleen is sent home from the Gaeltacht for speaking English, and it's there at the Gaeltacht, ambling back along country roads in pure darkness, that a boy from Dublin talks his tongue right into your mouth, holds you closely in the dark and calls it French kissing. He says this in English. Thank you.
Take my hand and see how far we've climbed. Green and blue line.
Martin Cowley had played Claudius to my Laertes in our school's production of Hamlet. Now in Duke Street, I'm watching an RUC district inspector beat Martin repeatedly across the back with a blackthorn stick. I'm one of 400 or 500 people on a march organized by Derry Housing Action Committee and the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association to protest the many inequities suffered by the North's Catholic population. We're there defying a ban imposed by Northern Ireland's Home Secretary, William Craig, and our progress is halted by a three-deep cordon of RUC officers. I remember my old history teacher at St. Columb's College, John Hume, urging everyone to sit down in peaceful, passive resistance. We sang, "We shall not be moved." At some point, the officers charge into the crowd, losing control, indiscriminately wielding their batons, or, if they were a district inspector, their badge of office, a blackthorn stick. The status quo was coming down ruthlessly on this challenge to its control and authority. The reason I'm here telling my story, being but one of the number of demonstrators attacked and charged, is that Trevor McBride, a photographer friend of my father, whom I had often sold papers to in our shop, had taken a sequence of photographs recording the moments I was grabbed, then beaten, then dragged along the street. These pictures appeared in papers, magazines, and televised news throughout the world, and won Trevor UK Photographer of the Year. Given the graphic evidence of police overreaction captured in these photographs, when the trials came around, there was intense international interest in how the police would attempt to justify the charge against me of assaulting them. The defending lawyers decided, therefore, to have my case heard last, to have it represent a kind of climax to the pantomime the fortnight of trials was expected to be. More shocking to me than the eruption of violence on Duke Street was witnessing during those 2 weeks how, in spite of overwhelming eyewitness and other evidence to the contrary, the magistrate declared every police officer innocent and every charged marcher guilty. As my case was called, and the lawyers were reminding me to say nothing but yes or no in answer to any questions, an usher hurried through the court and whispered in the magistrate's ear. The Home Secretary had declared an amnesty for all demonstrators charged. My case was thereby prevented from becoming the subject of worldwide scrutiny. From a young age, I had always found it hard not to speak out against injustice, which is why I was on the October the 5th march. I'd been expelled from St. Columb's College for trying to start a student representative council, had been a member of the Northern Ireland Young Socialists and an active supporter of the civil rights movement. At Queen's University, I was involved with Women's Liberation and founded the first gay rights organisation in Ireland. Looking back on these movements I was involved with, there are things I can't help but observe, and with some sadness. What strikes me is, the more rights that were being fought for back then have been won, the more grievous the exponents of those movements today so often proclaim their oppression and deprivations to be. History has shown us how frequently once necessary movements of liberation are taken over by elements who become addicted to the status of victim their movement's struggles were intended to free them from, who must therefore seek out ever new forms of oppression and offence, new enemies, enemies who must be intimidated into compliance or silence. Stalking and destroying those targeted as enemies often becomes more important than the defence and welfare of the alleged victims the movements nominally represent. The movements become as rigid and intolerant of dissent as the forces they were first created to overcome. And the weapons deployed to shut down any challenge to such victim orthodoxies are the destruction of character and reputation, the smearing of perceived enemies with one ism or phobia or another. Increasingly today, I watch as these weapons are wielded with as much ruthlessness as were the batons and blackthorn sticks on October the 5th, 1968.
Pat Hume is looking at old photos from the march. All men, she says, or nearly. That's how it was. Her husband marched that day. She was at home, 8 months pregnant and with the couple's 3 small children. Pat's memory of the morning of what became Bloody Sunday in 1972 is, "Oh my God, I think I'm pregnant again." There were women on Duke Street that October day in 1968, great women. But mostly in those early days, the women of Derry were not marching, but minding. Struggling nonetheless. No one could have gone out if they had not stayed at home. The chant might have been "one man, one vote," but it was women who bore the brunt of rearing families in the gerrymandered slums. John Hume used to say, "I'm the parcel, but Pat delivers me." It's an oddly charming statement, but there's something enigmatic about it. Maybe because Pat's role as the wife of that visionary leader is really quite complicated, as John was well aware. What everyone who knows them acknowledges is that Pat was every bit as involved in the transformation of Northern Ireland as her husband. He could not have done a thing without her. She's an unsung hero who doesn't want to be sung. She does her best to dissuade me from writing about her. I'm boring as hell, she says. Write about the women who were out there campaigning. Write about Maureen O'Doherty, Kitty O'Kane, Sheila McLean, Cathy Harkin. Yes, yes, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, but to get back to Pat. Mary Robinson said the great civil rights campaigner Inez McCormack taught her that sometimes you can be more effective if you don't feel the need to take the credit. Mary Beard says that if women are to be included in history, we need to look at leadership as being about more than just the single charismatic figure. We need to think collaboratively and about power as the ability to be effective, to make a difference to the world. Early evidence of Pat's power of influence. John was training to be a priest when he met her. She was known back then as Babs, Babs Hone. Pat ran the Hume household. She was also the breadwinner, a teacher, a surprisingly stern teacher, I'm told. Some were misled by her beauty and her ready smile into thinking she'd be a walkover. She had shimmering blue eyes and a swathe of wheat-coloured hair which she wore in a plait. She was 21 when she taught her first class. There were 56 teenagers in it. The Humes relied on another woman too. This was Molly Doherty, known as Nana. She looked after the children. Reliable, practical, and full of laughter, Molly kept the family afloat for 23 years. Pat says that when she got in from school, Molly would be out the door like a shooting star. She doesn't blame her. Our house wasn't the easiest, she says. It wasn't just the five mad feckers, as the Hume children were described to me by one of them, Mo. There were also what Pat calls the unpredictabilities. The house never emptied, she says. A constant stream of people called on the phone or to the door, seeking help with problems, which included, according to Mo, housing, brew not coming through, sun lifted by the British Army, someone had the shit kicked out of them, passport required. It was Pat who spent her evenings dealing with all of this, who attended funerals and knew everybody. After John became an MEP in 1979, she formally took over running his constituency office. John was often away, setting up credit unions, attending parliaments, meeting world leaders. He was Washington, Dublin, Brussels, London, Belfast. Pat was Derry. She was the Hume's Derryness. But John took no significant decisions ever without consulting his wife. His trust in her political judgment was complete. There were always visitors. John was hospitable. Pat was the host. He could make Irish stew under supervision. Once John invited a bishop and his wife to lunch. Pat, who was about to give birth, served boiled eggs. Every so often, she admits, I would erupt. They lived under siege. For decades, every day brought hate mail, threats and abusive phone calls from unionists, from Republicans. IRA supporters stoned the house and petrol bombed it. Pat did her best to shield the children. Mo recalls her mother swearing just once and with just one word when she opened the door one night to find her car and the windows of the house in flames. When the Hume Adams talks were revealed, John was being denounced by the British and Irish establishments while acts of mass murder were proliferating in the north. It was hell, Pat says. I don't know how we survived. John, in truth, did not survive well. His health is broken. He has dementia and now another brutal illness that is stripping him of his faculties. Pat has become the memory John has lost. For years, she has been his guide, by his side to mediate encounters with strangers and friends, always gracious, always knowing what to say. If John says the wrong thing, people let it pass now. Pat says Derry has become a city of kindness. Pat has had cancer and other afflictions, but she says she's reached her 40 years and she looks back with gratitude. She has great friends, children she's proud of, grandchildren to snuggle up with on the sofa, and, as of this summer, a first great-grandchild. She walks the banks of the Foyle. She loves Lisa McGee's Derry Girls and can recite and discuss in detail entire episodes. Remember the cream horn on Pump Street? She loves to quote Seamus Heaney. There is one among us who never swerved from all his instincts told him was right action, who stood his ground in the indicative. She's thinking about John. I'm thinking about Pat too. Her modesty is part of what her daughter Mo calls her phenomenal grace. Thank you.
The October 5th anniversary should be an occasion for looking forward and outwards, not back to the past or in on ourselves. The movement sparked by October 5th widened the perspective of hundreds of thousands who had been hemmed in by oppression. It challenged the standard orange-green narrative of Northern Ireland history, held out the possibility of a society where social justice and equality prevailed. That vision was to fade far too soon, but it gave us a glimpse of what was possible, of what could be, of what still could be. The people power strategy of the civil rights movement achieved more in a few years than electoral politics or armed struggle over the previous 50 years or since. A point system for housing allocation, laws against job discrimination, one person, one vote, constituency boundaries redrawn, Londonderry Corporation abolished, the B Specials disbanded. These demands of the civil rights movement were all conceded. This wasn't nearly enough for those among us who were out radically to transform society as a whole, but there was nobody of any tendency within the civil rights movement who didn't cheer the changes. It wasn't a bad start, we said, and it illuminated the way forward. The civil rights movement drew together people from a wide range of political beliefs. Labour Party people, Marxists, communists, liberals, Republicans, and most of all, independent citizens of no particular political persuasion. Students and trade unionists, Catholic and Protestant, marched behind the same banner. Of course, the forward march of the movement failed to maintain momentum. It was diverted, driven back, fragmented by sectarian attacks, by the guns of the British Army, the summoning up of ancestral spirits. Sharp internal disagreements didn't help either. What I remember most is not this or that argument or incident, but being part of the crowd, the feeling of being there in such numbers and common cause, transforming the politics around us by our own collective action. That was a heady thing to happen on the dusty streets of Derry. Maybe some of us got carried away a little bit, but the buzz was brilliant. The left looked, for example, an inspiration to what was happening around the world. The Black Civil Rights Movement in the United States, the campaign against the American war on Vietnam, the student uprising in France, the resistance of the people of Prague to Soviet imperialism. This remains my perspective. As Marx observed, it is only by breaking the chains ourselves that we can slough off the muck of ages, the inculcated ideas of deference which hold us back and hold us down. The only adequate acknowledgement of October 5th lies in resumption of the forward march. We had a housing shortage then, and a housing crisis today. Young people sofa surfing, private rents rocketing, The only jobs on offer tend to be hallmarked by insecurity, 0 hours, minimum wages. Any notion of the dignity of labour regarded as a laughing matter. Damp rooms and dead-end jobs still zap the spirit, as well as harming the health of our children. And we still live under Thatcher's anti-union laws, devolved to the Assembly 20 years ago and imposed on local workers by every executive since. Equal marriage and a woman's right to choose are still denied. Repression by the state and cover-up continues. Tony Taylor from Creggan has been imprisoned without trial for close on 1,000 days. There is fierce resistance from the ruling class to letting light into the murk of Bloody Sunday, Ballymurphy, King's Mills, and all the other atrocities which mark, like milestones, the Via Dolorosa of our troubles. On all sides in the squalid war we've lived through, the truth is still being trashed. We need a civil rights movement fit for the 21st century, mass-based, militant, neither orange nor green, fighting without compromise for the rights of all the excluded, and we need it across the island. It is on this basis that our most difficult and divisive problems can be faced head-on in a way which doesn't further divide us. If we need a rebel song to set the pace, we might march to the beat of Chrissie Hynde and the Pretenders in their great album, Last of the Independents. She was writing of the murder in 1970 by the National Guard of 4 Kent State, Ohio students protesting against the pitiless bombing of Cambodia. The world is getting strange. We'll never lose heart. We can't wait for the old world to die before we make a new start. Bring on the revolution. Keep the pressure on. Don't want to die for nothing. I hear the children sing. Freedom will ring. Freedom will ring.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall.
That was a special Sunday Miscellany live from the Playhouse in Derry. It was first broadcast in October 2018 to mark the 50th anniversary of the Duke Street Civil Rights March of the 5th of October 1968. And we rebroadcast it this morning in full to mark the loss this week of one of the civil rights movement's leading figures, later SDLP leader and Nobel Peace Laureate John Hume. The scripts this morning were Notes for the 5th of October by Anne Devlin, Don't Speak to the Brits, Just Pretend They Don't Exist, a poem by Colette Bryce, Battens and Blackthorn Sticks by Andy Hines, Phenomenal Grace by Susan McKay, and Freedom Will Ring by Eamon McCann. The music was The Rebel Girl by Joe Hill, sung by the Henry Girls, River Flow, River Divide by Reva, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free by Billy Taylor and Dick Dallas, performed by Gay McIntyre and the John Layton Trio. The Coolin, played by Clodagh Warnock on fiddle, accompanied by Jolene McLaughlin on harp, and We Shall Overcome, sung by the Henry Girls. On sound were Martin Curran and Cian McAvoy. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey, and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.